This is 103.3 WZND's Bird's Eye View, here to give you a comprehensive look at the Bloomington Normal community's most important issues. Investigative reporting from the award-winning WZND news team, here for you. Unbiased, engaging, and comprehensive. Bird's Eye View starts now.
Hello and welcome to the September edition of Bird's Eye View. In this month, we're taking a deep dive into the story behind the Barton McNeil case. We'll hear accounts of Barton's character from his family and friends, the events of the case itself, the opinion of the public, how murder trials function from a legal perspective, and what's next for Barton. I'm your Bird's Eye View producer, Colleen Holden.
I'm your co-host, Gavin Broderick.
And I'm your other co-host, Ben Howell.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm fantastic. I'm excited to get going.
I'm doing great myself. I think this episode is incredibly interesting.
Glad to hear it. We have a great show coming up shortly, but before we begin, we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Bird's Eye View on 103.3 WZND.
News now on 103.3 WZND.
Welcome back to Bird's Eye View. This month's topic is on the Barton McNeil case.
Barton McNeil was convicted of murdering his daughter Christina in 1999, a wrongful conviction, according to Barton and his supporters. One of the most overlooked things, according to his friends and family, who he really is.
It's now time to ask a simple question. Who is Barton McNeil?
What makes him likable? Happy, upbeat, positive kind of person.
Larry Mize is understandably and unapologetically complimentary of his friend Bart McNeil. With a relationship dating back to CB radios in the 1970s, it's no surprise they're still sharing their voices, 20-minute phone calls at a time.
You never really saw him down and out, and still to this day, you know, we stay in pretty close contact. I haven't heard from him for probably about a week now, and that's not that often.
Bart's admiration among friends like Larry comes as no shock to cousin Chris Ross.
He was always a level, you know, fun, kind of a fun-loving guy. And so he had a lot of friends. He was very well-liked.
Or former neighbors sharing stories of his involved parenting.
He was thought of as a very good father. Even neighbors that in and around where he lived thought highly of him. One had commented how he had asked, is this a safe neighborhood for me to teach my daughter how to ride her bicycle?
For Larry, Chris, and many who knew Bart before his life changed that morning, they still empathize with his pain and unique grief.
He never got the opportunity to deal with the loss of his child. He was immediately into the mode of having to try and save his ass.
It's easy to see where those close to Bart stand on who committed the crime we're discussing.
They arrested my cousin within literally 24 hours before they even launched an investigation against Mazook. And then from there on out, it was, how do we convict Barton McNeil and not put any scrutiny on Mazook?
Although, you couldn't catch Larry Mize in the same room as Mazook if the world depended on it.
Never met her. Thank God.
Perhaps this distaste is not just based on a relation to McNeil, but a reflection of Mazook's eventual convicted crimes.
She strangled this old lady to death, put her in the trunk, took her up by Kankakee or something, and buried her up there. And that's a cold-blooded killer right there.
It's not random chance, in Mize's opinion.
Suspected Mazook all along, and then she turns out to strangle her mother-in-law to death. Well, what a coincidence there, you know what I mean?
As this case continues a pursuit of a fair retrial, his loved ones point out all the reasons Bart could be bitter. But McNeil keeps his mental, which no one can ever shake.
By and large, he stayed the same person. And when I told him this, you know, it's amazing how you managed to keep your head together. And his comment was, man, they've taken everything away from me. They're not getting my mind, too.
Publicly, it's those like Chris and Larry who fight for their friend nearly a quarter century later.
This guy just didn't get a fair trial. That is what needs to be corrected. If we don't correct these problems, they'll persist. It could happen to you. It could happen to your son. It could happen to, you know, anybody.
Reporting for WZND and the Bird's Eye View team, I'm Mikey Fornelli.
Mikey took the chance to sit down with three of the people closest to Bart, including his cousin Chris and two friends. From Barton's team, all fingers point to Mazook, comparatively an evil figure in the story of Bart and Christina, who years after was convicted of another murder, that of her mother-in-law at the time. She was also convicted of felony child abuse, months after Bart was convicted for his daughter's murder.
When we talk about true crime, especially crime that's happened in the past, it's easy to see people as characters, that they aren't really people so much as they are characters in a story. This piece shows that these are real people who had tragic events shape the course of their lives.
With such a polarizing case, it's important to have a clear idea of the cold hard facts. Our very own Ben Howell sat down with the police and reviewed the original 911 calls to piece together what exactly happened that fateful day.
911.
On June 16, 1998, Barton McNeil called 911 to report that his daughter was not breathing and he believed that she could be dying. In turn, Bloomington Fire and Police Departments were dispatched and met Barton at his home. Public Information Officer for the City of Bloomington, Bryce Jansen, explains what that process looks like from the perspective of law enforcement.
So police respond. A supervisor also responds with that officer. So you have two sets of eyes taking a look at the scene. You know, are there any signs of forced entry? Is there anything that seems suspicious? You know, what's the age of the patient? That type of thing. If anything jumps out to us as suspicious, you know, through our initial investigation, we would consult with the Criminal Investigations Division.
Upon their arrival at the McNeil home, paramedics, as well as the county coroner, pronounced Christina McNeil deceased, an unfortunate victim of an asthma attack in the middle of the night. Jansen further explains how police investigate a death scene after an individual is considered deceased.
Supervisor shows up on scene. I would, you know, ask the relative or any possible witnesses, you know, when was the last time you saw this person? How long have they been down for? What type of medical conditions do they have?
Hours later, after law enforcement and paramedics had left the McNeil home, Barton came to new conclusions about what happened to his daughter. Bushes were trampled at the residence, and Christina's bedroom window had been tampered with. Barton let the 911 dispatcher know what he thought, requesting a homicide investigation at his home.
I need a detective here immediately.
Okay.
I don't know if they saw this or not.
Jansen details how police determine a death as suspicious, that it is usually for the individual officer to decide at the scene.
A lot of times something could be suspicious just based off the age. You know, if we go to a scene and there's a 20-year-old who's deceased, it's not very common, unless there's some kind of underlying health condition, for a 20-year-old to be found deceased. So that can be a huge red flag right there in and of itself, is, you know, the age of the victim, the apparent condition of the victim.
After a death is qualified as suspicious, police initiate specific protocols to handle that given case. It may not necessarily be a homicide. It could also be a suicide or possibly an accidental overdose. Jansen tells us more about what law enforcement does in these cases when they need to figure out how an individual died under suspicious circumstances.
And it could be 2 o'clock in the morning. It could be, you know, 3 in the afternoon, whatever it is. It would be an all call. We would have all the CID commanders would be coming in, all their detectives would be coming in, and all the crime scene investigators would be coming in. They would be going to the scene, taking photographs, collecting evidence. They'd be going door to door, talking to neighbors, seeing if there's any surveillance footage in the area, and pretty much getting as many eyes on this case at a time and trying to figure out what happened.
What Barton and the police can agree upon is that Christina died that night in June of 1998. From that point on, there are two different stories. The two parties did not agree on evidence of foul play at the scene. They did not agree on the importance of the fact that Barton broke up with his girlfriend that night, who was later convicted of murder. And most important of all, they cannot agree on who killed Christina McNeil. For Bird's Eye View, I'm Ben Howell.
This piece is such an important one because it sets up how police are supposed to act when a murder is committed. This shows how the Bloomington police in 1998 failed to properly gather evidence and take into consideration all possibilities.
There's still plenty more to talk about today. You're listening to Bird's Eye View on 103.3 WZND.
This is WZND's Bird's Eye View.
Welcome back. You're listening to Bird's Eye View on 103.3 WZND. If you are just now tuning in, this month's focus is on the 1999 murder conviction of Barton McNeil.
Barton McNeil's story is one that lives in infamy. With the perspectives of some of the major players in the case already reviewed, it's time to look at what the public thinks from the voice of the public, a journalist. Kaylee Sugimoto from the news team sat down with Scott Reeder to detail the case from the perspective of a bystander.
It's rare to have a crime story quite like Barton McNeil's, and it's even more rare to have one in a small town like Bloomington. However, false convictions aren't. Investigative journalist Scott Reeder has studied McNeil's case at length. He spoke about the conviction pattern that he's noticed in McLean County.
The other thing is, wrongful convictions are a huge problem within McLean County. This has happened in a number of other cases during that same era. So we really need to have somebody stepping forward and saying, with an open heart, hey, sometimes we may have made some mistakes in the past.
Although Reeder has investigated many other cases, he hasn't seen one as unique as McNeil's. He shared exactly what makes McNeil's case that much more interesting.
I read through the court documents. I read what evidence was presented to the judge. And I looked at what kind of defense he got from the public defender. And honestly, I don't see a case to be made that this guy is guilty. There really isn't any compelling evidence pointing to that.
As discussed earlier, police must follow certain procedures when investigating a crime scene. However, the way that Christina McNeil's death was examined left a few holes. Reeder shared his insight on why he thinks the crime scene evaluation was done unprofessionally.
They finally send somebody out to look at it and run a crime scene, and they do a sloppy job, and it was not particularly good. And then the next day, when the coroner's report comes back saying that they think the girl may have been suffocated, then they go and immediately look at Bart, because he was there, totally discarding the fact that he is the one that insisted there was a homicide in the first place.
With evidence not seeming to quite add up, many wonder how a conviction like this could even happen in today's world. Reeder believes that McNeil's conviction is not a conspiracy against him, but rather a failure in the local justice system.
How many murders do they really deal with in Bloomington? I mean, they don't deal with very many. I mean, it's a white-collar town. It doesn't have a lot of homicides. The people that work those cases don't have a lot of experience. I think that they got tunnel vision early on that this must be the guy that did it and decided on that, and they didn't let their focus drift away from him.
The longer Barton McNeil stays behind bars, the questioning of his time becomes louder to the public. With little responsibility being publicly taken, the risk of having an unfair trial and wrongful conviction seems possible to residents in McLean County.
Somebody has to point out, like, you know, maybe we made a mistake here. But I don't see any kind of reflection going on in the police department or within the state's attorney's office or anyone. I mean, it's like, the presumption now that we got a conviction is he's guilty. Mind-boggling what we're dealing with here.
For Bird's Eye View, I'm Kaylee Sugimoto.
Scott Reeder made an entire series on the Barton McNeil case. He's been a great resource for us. I thought it was so interesting to hear how Barton McNeil's conviction wasn't a conspiracy against him. It was just laziness in our justice system.
Furthermore, on that point, one of the most important things was what Bart tried to bring to the investigators' attention that day after Christina was murdered. There were bushes stepped on outside of her bedroom window, the fan on her windowsill was moved to the floor, and the window screen itself had also been tampered with. There were large holes in it, the frame was bent, and the locking mechanisms were off their tracks.
With so many glaring holes in the case against Barton, it's natural to wonder how exactly he ended up losing his trial. Joey Delahunty from the news team sat down with a lawyer to discuss the typical procedure of murder trials and what it must have taken to get Barton behind bars.
In 1999, Barton McNeil's defense team worked to prevent his conviction in the murder case of his daughter Christina. However, as we know, the trial did not end up in their favor. McNeil was not judged by a jury of his peers, but rather solely by the judge in what is known as a bench trial. Former prosecutor and legal studies professor at Illinois State University, Jason Sieslick, explains how a bench trial differs from a more traditional one.
Okay, so in that case, it's just a judge. They are the finders of fact in this particular case. So they were adjudicating this case and evaluating witnesses and determining whether the state had provided enough evidence to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt.
In a bench trial, the judge is the only one who decides if a defendant has been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. However, the prosecution still has to prove that, just as thoroughly as in a more traditional trial. Sieslick gives us some insight into how that doubt is created on the defense's side.
From a defense attorney's job, their primary function, if there is not an affirmative defense, is to try to show that there is reasonable doubt in this case. And they do that through cross-examination. And if they choose to put on witnesses or put on evidence, try to show that there is reasonable doubt. Because if a case goes to trial, obviously the state is saying that the person did it and the defense is saying, no, they didn't do it. And so obviously both can't be true.
Proving a reasonable doubt is one of the most important responsibilities of a defense team. A significant facet of that is working in tandem with evidence gathered by investigators. However, defense teams may sometimes have problems with the methods of investigation.
It appears as though the petitioner at some point during the investigation had mentioned to the police that, hey, Ms. Nolan was involved, or you need to investigate her in some way, shape, or form. What they did with that information or where they went, I don't know. And I'm not going to speculate. But I think what they're alleging is they had a duty to follow up on certain information and failed to do so. And that failure to do so caused irreparable harm to their client here.
Sieslik, as a former prosecutor himself, has some insight into how it feels to be involved in a murder trial. Although procedurally, murder trials aren't too different from any other criminal case, the nature of the crime raises the stakes for all those involved.
Whether you're a defense attorney or a prosecutor, you understand that somebody's liberty is at stake. Now, we're not a death penalty state, so again, it's somebody's freedom at stake here. So you take that very serious. It's definitely high stakes on both sides.
Whether it be the original case in 1999 or the upcoming retrial in November, McNeil and his defense team face an uphill battle. They have to prove McNeil's innocence in a case that's lasted 24 years and is still ongoing. Between bench trials and the high stress of criminal court in general, it has not and will not be an easy path. For Bird's Eye View, I'm Joey Delahunty.
Calls for reform to the criminal justice system in the U.S. are all but new. Frankly, Barton's case speaks to a larger issue in Illinois itself. The state has one of the highest wrongful conviction rates in the country, being number one for exonerations, with 520.
This piece, just like Kaylee's, shows how our legal system works, and when you take in consideration both of these pieces, you can see just how wrong this trial went and how the defense team failed to follow up on certain information. That lack of follow-up may have been the straw that broke the camel's back and caused McNeil to be sent to prison.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Bird's Eye View on 103.3 WZND.
This is WZND's Bird's Eye View.
Welcome back. You're listening to Bird's Eye View on 103.3 WZND. If you're just now tuning in, this month's focus is the story behind the conviction of Barton McNeil. So far, we've covered Barton's character according to his family and friends, the events of the case itself, the opinion of the public, and how murder trials function from a legal perspective.
You may be thinking, that's it. We went over what happened and there's no hope. But you'd be wrong. I had a chance to look at what's next for McNeil.
So far, we've talked about what's happened in the past, from the events of the murder to the trial of McNeil. But what lies next for McNeil? In June, McNeil's lawyers pushed for new evidence to be released.
We're asking that we be allowed to introduce evidence that corroborates the issue which the court did advance to the third stage, namely whether or not the search out of court statement happened, whether it would likely change the result at retrial, which necessarily involves asking the question that the chamber's opinion says that we must ask, which is whether or not it was corroborated. So our position is that it should be admitted. We knew that there would be a dispute here. That's why we teed it up for the court in this motion in limine. But at the end of the day, our request is that the court consider the evidence as it considers the actual innocence claim that it was advanced to the third stage.
The third stage they're talking about is just releasing the records in dispute. Barton's lawyers with the Exoneration Project were able to unseal Department of Child and Family Services records. Those records showed that Ms. Sook had a history of child abuse and that she threatened to kill Christina. Of course, the state's attorney's office pushed back.
But I don't think it's appropriate for the court to enter this very broad in scope discovery request at this point in time, given how narrow the issues are that have been advanced to third stage. Thank you.
Judge William Yoder presided over the hearing to unseal these records. He made clear that they were not retrying the case.
Post-conviction is not a retrial of the underlying offense. It's a collateral attack on a prior judgment alleging a substantial denial of state or federal constitutional rights.
The defense was able to make two allegations with this new evidence. One, that Ms. Sook confessed to killing her mother-in-law, Linda Tida, by strangulation. And two, that Michelle Nolan, her former daughter-in-law, abused her and her father, Andy Nolan. Judge Yoder agreed to permit the evidence.
This is not a retrial or mini-trial of the original case. This is whether or not those two assertions would result in this case being set back for a new trial. And so the court is going to limit the evidence to those specific assertions
The next step in McNeil's case is a November 21st evidentiary hearing, where this new evidence will be used to show the courts that a retrial is in order. If the court agrees, a retrial for the murder of Christina McNeil will be set. For Bird's Eye View, I'm Gavin Broderick.
It's crazy to hear that after all these years, Barton may actually have a chance to get back to his life and move on from the tragedy that struck him when Christina was murdered.
I'd like to give a quick shout-out to Chris Ross, who is Barton's cousin. He has been the biggest proponent for Barton, and he has not only put a spotlight on this story, but he has helped us with so many questions that we've had. We really appreciate his help this month.
Chris, as well as Barton's other supporters, have put together a showing of the Snapped Behind Bars episode from 2021 that is focused on Misook Nowlin. It mentions both the Linda Tida case as well as Barton's case. The showing is set for November 6th at 6:30 p.m. at the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University. It will be followed by a Q&A panel for the general public to ask questions about Barton's case.
If it's true that Barton is innocent and he is released from prison, that would mean that an innocent father has been in prison for the murder of his own daughter for 24 years. There is no amount of money or apologies that could right that wrong.
The story of Barton McNeil is full of polarizing beliefs. Those of the public, the police, his family, and the legal system have all been shared. But what matters most is if a judge will once again believe McNeil is a guilty man garnering sympathy from the public, or an innocent man fallen victim to actions without consequence, and consequence without action. That wraps up this month's edition of Bird's Eye View. If you missed any part of today's show, you can head over to WZND.com to listen to the full show right after this. Thank you for listening to Bird's Eye View.
This has been WZND's Bird's Eye View. Catch more WZND in-depth news every Sunday at noon with WZND's Second Look and Bird's Eye View. For previous episodes, find Bird's Eye View on the podcast tab at WZND.com.